Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin, working on the help desk, a networking engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech, you want to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy, and we are back. This is episode 6, and well, we haven't been around for a couple of weeks, have we? But we're back with a vengeance now. We've both been pretty busy, so what have you been up to?
Yeah, sorry to say we haven't been about. Just been busy with work and a bit of personal life taking over. So, but it's nice and sunny in the old UK this year. So what have I been up to? Mainly I've been working on more Office 365 migrations, but also been looking in a product called Microsoft Link, which is kind of their enterprise voice. So it's it kind of links in with Exchange, and but gives you the voice side of things. So, like, you know, if you've got Skype, well, it's kind of like Skype but for the corporate world. So you can instant message people in the office, or you can have conference calls over it, or you can actually make telephone calls between people. So what we're doing is, because the company I work for was purchased last year from another company, and we're currently running two separate Exchange servers and two separate domains, and we want to merge it all into one. And one of the driving things is that, because we're at two sites, it's hard to know when people are on the phone or not, and we've both got old aging phone systems. So we're, another part of Link is that you can integrate is a phone system, so you can get rid of the old phone systems, and you can have Link do it all for you. So you can, people at home can have, use their laptops as phones. In the office you can have desk phones, all kind of all links into one. But I'm sure as I get more into this project I can talk about it more. So what have you been up to, Andy?
Well, yeah, I mean, going on that, I've actually heard about that product. I think someone on another podcast has mentioned it actually, and it's looked quite intriguing at the time, so I might look into that myself a little bit. Yeah, I mean, I was involved in this little server job about a week or so ago. This guy called me up, and you could tell just by the first 30 seconds of the call, he knew too much about what he was trying to do. He was getting in the right... in the right mess with the server he was trying to set up, all because he already had a Windows 2000, I think it was Server 2000 set up on his network, and it was going through a BT router, but he'd set himself up a Windows 2003 server, and this new all-in-one, well, it was a 6-in-1 PC system that they had. I've never seen one before. I'm interested to know if anyone else has come across one of these before as well. It's basically one tower with multiple video card outputs, 6 keyboards, 6 monitors, 6 mice. And I didn't get into that much, but I'm assuming that runs like 6 different virtual machines for desktops. Apparently the reason I asked him why he went for that, apparently the reason for that is something to do with licensing, you see, because the way that it's done, there's only one license for the different products that they have, Photoshop, and they use a few other pieces of software like that. So instead of buying these systems, these licenses for these systems, you know, 6 or so times, which can get quite expensive, they just bought it once and had it in one all-in-one machine. Now, this all-in-one machine was running off a domain controller on a 2003 server, which this guy had built and loaded up about a week or so beforehand. Now, the problem that he had was every time he hooked up the new server to the network, the IP addresses just started to go crazy, and obviously thinking about it, the the way it was, the Windows 2000 server didn't have a DHCP controller, but the actual BT router itself did. And DHCP was active on that router. So as soon as he brought in the 2003 server, that tried to be the domain, that tried to be DHCP as well. And as a result, we'd have chaos. I mean, we've talked about that on a previous show, haven't we, about DHCP? I think that was on episode one, actually. Yeah. So the way he was explaining to me, I was there for about half an hour, and I was completely and totally confused because I didn't know what he was talking about. It was only until we sat down, got a big piece of paper, and drew out a good old-fashioned flow diagram of each workstation, where the servers were, what was connected to what, and things like that. Then we managed to figure out that at that point, the BT router was giving out all the IP addresses on its own DHCP server. This was only a temporary solution, because he did say that he'd be taking the old server out in about 3 or 4 weeks' time. And he couldn't think of a way of isolating the DHCP servers, you see. So after I went through it all, I just thought, well, isn't there a simple solution here of turn off the DHCP in the 2003 server, thus leaving it all up to the BT router to do that. And I explained what I was going to do. As he said, he actually thought that sounds too easy. He thought it was too easy. I said, well, let's do it. Let's see. That it should work absolutely fine. So as soon as we did it, turned it off. I think we had to turn it off and then reboot the server. We connected all the workstations up, and no problem. Everything worked fine. So I did say that it would be, and you could either correct me or confirm that when he gets rid of the original one and he's back to one, the 2003 server and the router only, and the old server's gone, I said it'd probably be best practice to put that DHCP back on again on the server and turn it off in the router.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it would work, but it might. I'm just thinking best practice. I know the other one will work, but I was there for a couple of hours. Most of it was trying to figure out what he was trying to do.
Yeah.
What was coming from where, these IP addresses. I was trying to figure out where are these coming from, what's dishing these out. So I was only there a couple of hours. He realised in the end, God, it was a simple little solution. And actually said, if I'd got a piece of paper and drew it out myself, I'd have come up with that myself, he said. Mm-hmm. I said, so, I thought, well, you didn't.
So sort of paying the big bucks for.
That's it, yeah. That's troubleshooting, isn't it, really? I mean, I suppose have you had people, we all have, really, but can you think of anyone off the top of your head that's phoned you up and you could not understand what on earth they were trying to explain to you?
Yeah. I'm always drawing out bits of paper and drawing on whiteboards.
Yeah,
doing it today with one of my techies, trying to work out the best way of doing something, and he was a bit confused, so I drawed it all out and he goes, oh yeah, I see what you mean now, Al. So it's always good. So I don't understand, do you really understand why he had on this desk, did he have six monitors, is that what you're saying?
That's right, yeah.
He had so it's a bit like a control room or something, like you've seen in the movies kind of thing. Is that what you kind of...
It was the way it was laid out, there was a big desk which could fit six people around it. And these were for all the people that worked in that office. So
right,
it's,
okay.
It's a bit like having six towers, really.
Okay.
All connected to the...
So he basically had a server with like six. Did it have like six screens and six keyboards? Is that what it's saying?
Yeah.
And six monitors. Okay. Yeah. So it's a bit like a terminal server, but running from one machine, but not actually using RDP. It's like Did it have some sort of special graphics card on it then?
He had it built by somebody, some company. I'll have to find out where, but he had it built, and it's basically it's got three graphics cards in it, and each graphics card's got two monitors on it.
Yeah, I think I've seen these before, but I never actually managed to get one myself. Actually, seen one in actual real life.
It has to be a half decent machine, because it all shares the resources of that one machine, even though you're running six. So, the biggest downside to that particular six in one, he called it a six in one, was the machine itself only had 2 gig of memory on it. And when you think about it, that 2 gig of memory is running six desktops.
Yeah,
basically.
Okay.
So, and they were running things like Photoshop, Outlook.
Really, with 2 gig of RAM?
2 gig of RAM, yeah. In fact, when I was there, there was only two of the six machines in use. And you know, you go into Task Manager, and you can see how much, how big your page file is, you know. It was currently using 3 gig. So just on two desktops in use, it was using the 2 gig of the RAM and 1 gig virtual memory, I assume. So I said, it might be a good idea to get more memory in it. So they agreed. They actually, while I was there, they ordered off what's that website called where they scan your memory for you and tell you what you've got?
Is it Kingston or something?
It's like Kingston. Can't remember the name of it'll come to me, but they basically ordered 4 more gig. The machine itself had 3 slots, so it only had 1 2-gig stick in it. So they got a few more gig for it, which will help them run a bit quicker. But that was that one.
Anything else?
Yeah, I mean, we've I've not long took over. It's actually a youth club. In fact, we've talked about this particular one on the show before, haven't we, about it was that system we were looking at with the email problem. If you go back to one of the previous shows, you can listen to that as well. But that was the one with the email problem. You know, it was sending out or it was blocking emails going out.
Yeah.
So yeah, what they've basically had is, so they've got an SBS server in there, and they had 10 XP machines. Through the fact that XP's now gone, and the machines themselves, although they were quite decent machines, are obviously getting old now, and they were running slow. They finally got the funds together to replace them all and get 10 new machines. So yeah, once these 10 new machines have gone in, which I'm currently in the middle of doing, they want me to, you know, basically maintain them and service them, maintenance contract, you know, that kind of thing. So
yeah, okay.
So that's one thing that we'll probably be talking about over the next couple of shows, possibly, about what we've been doing and how we can do it, how we can manage, you know, a server and 10 PCs remotely. You know, how we can push out updates, how we can update programs on each workstation, how we can fault find or connect up, say, one evening when the workers aren't there. You know, how we can do this. Different, so there's a basic different ways of managing a pretty small network, really, isn't it? But it's the same principles.
So
it's the same principle whether it's 100 workstations or 10. So it should relate to everybody.
Yes, yeah, so you're going to ask me, like, how would you kind of look after that kind of thing? So,
yeah.
So you want to talk about deploying updates to all the machines? Is probably something called WSUS, which is the update service. So it's basically like Windows Update, but you do it from one centralization. So I was talking about last episode, but you basically you set up your server and that downloads all the updates, and because this PC is all going out to the internet, it goes back to that one PC, that one server, sorry, and then it downloads the updates. But with group policy and stuff, you can configure it so that when those updates can be deployed. Also, you can do a fail safe. So, Clark, have you heard about the? Probably have other people talk about the blue screen to death.
Oh yes.
Where they said an update went out, and kind of what I do is I kind of like to leave it 2 weeks before I deploy updates. So what you can do is that you can WSUS will download all the updates, but you have to approve them before they get sent out. Okay. So I'd leave it 2 weeks, and then you basically approve the updates, and then the PC will come along and pick the updates. So you, if you'd have had that, obviously Microsoft pulled it before 2 weeks, then you obviously wouldn't be pushed out. We need to put some sort of monitoring tools on the server to obviously make sure that all the no disk errors or
yep.
making sure that that disks aren't filling up if a server stops, you know about it. Things like also you want to make sure you're monitoring the hardware as well, because a lot of the times, like if you've got a RAID card or something in it, like if it's an HP server or a Dell server, unless you install the actual Dell tools or the HP tools, it's not actually monitoring the hardware. So if you have a disk fail, Windows is not going to report that because obviously you haven't got the HP tools on it.
All right.
So
right.
We recommend doing that. Also, what I was thinking about is they use that GFI Max product, so it's like $1 per machine. So you install that on each of the thing. That $1 a month gives you antivirus, remote access to that PC, and it also monitors that server. So it also monitor those PCs to make sure, like if there's any errors or anything, you get notified about them. So it's like a console, and obviously I think it's a bit more for going on the server. But obviously you can put that into your maintenance cost. So there's lots of things you can look at. But I'm guessing we might have a bit of chat offline with that, and then come up with some stuff, and then we'll report back into the podcast. I'm guessing that's the main thing that I'd look after, is making sure the disk space doesn't fill up, errors in the event log, server stopping, and definitely then making sure your hardware is monitoring correctly. And also, what sort of backup have they got at the moment? Or
they haven't really, so that's another thing to consider. The backup has basically consisted of when I said to them one day, "Do you have any backup?" They said, "What do you mean by backup?" So that tells you they haven't got any. So what I did on that particular day, because it was a bit concerned just in case anything happened, I manually copied all the user directories. It wasn't a lot of data though, luckily, onto an external hard drive. So there is a sort of backup, but nothing very good at the minute.
Okay.
So,
well, I reckon we should write down a bit of paper, all the things like that, and then we can go through and we won't forget, or start a Google Docs share, and then we can write down all the different things.
That sounds good. Yeah, I mean, I know I've seen the WSUS before. I've tried it myself. I think there's a standalone version, isn't there, or just where you can it runs like just off a portable hard drive or something, so you can download updates to that. And then whenever you go to a PC, you can plug it in and then deploy whatever updates there that's available. So is the server one the same as that one? Or does it work the same, basically? Or
yeah, it does, yeah.
Okay, so using that should be pretty familiar. So
And then pushing out software is... I really haven't done much about that, but that brings me on to my next thing. But pushing out software for 10 machines is probably just easy enough to just install the software on each machine. But it's definitely getting something into. I was listening to a podcast. I think it's one of the service show podcast, and there's a guy on there called Brian from DevOpsMastery.com. It's a really interesting podcast. It's a new kind of thing what's come out in the last couple of years. It's basically called DevOps. Mm-hmm. So it's all designed around people who run websites, applications inside companies. And you get the developers who are kind of like writing the code, but then you've got the people who are actually running the servers underneath it, who are the operations. And it's all about kind of getting everyone to work together. So like you understand how all your infrastructure works. It's all about scripting everything as well and making sure that how everything works. So like if you have a failure, you know how to get back to where you were. So it's really interesting stuff. And the guy was talking about scripting, and he says if you don't know scripting in the next 5 years, you won't have a job in IT. We said it like if you, not in your current job, but if you lost your job and had to move to somewhere else, everyone needs to be scripting. So it's got me kind of thinking that I've always liked scripting, but it always kind of scares me with PowerShell, with the red old text, with everything going wrong, or that you'll kind of do something wrong and delete all your files or something. So check out that DevOpsMastery.com. Check it out. It's like a bit like a mini podcast series, and it's kind of tells you all the different things. It's like seems like he's telling you like what's the difference between an incident and what the problem is. So like, if you have an incident with a server or something, it's just a one-off. That's just called a classic incident. So if a server stopped or something, and all we did is start up again, you never have again that problem again. That's just called an incident. But a problem is where if you have that incident keeps happening over and over again, and then that problem, you have to come up with a fix to fix that problem. So it's all very interesting stuff. Yeah. Definitely check that out. When I did it, I actually was brave enough to actually write my own script. Basically, I was looking after doing a bit of a server health check over 100 servers, and then we need to change the domain admin password because too many people know it. And one of the things you need to do is you need to check what server account are running, what server account user accounts are being run under. So when you have a service like Backup Exec or SQL Server, you can run that as a domain admin. In best practice, you should run that. You should have a service account for each of those different things. So if you change your domain admin password and you've got those services running under the domain admin, all those services will stop because you need to go into each of those services and change the password as well. So I wrote a little script which basically using WMI and Visual Basic script, it basically went to all the servers in a text file and basically pulled down what the names of all, if there's a service which was running under the domain admin account. So I was very impressed with myself on that.
That sounds pretty good.
That was just a so it's basically just a case of googling it and stealing other people's code and pushing it all together to make it your own code. So it's really interesting, and it's like the guy was saying that scripting is that once you've done it once, you don't have to do it again. So like when you're rolling out your applications, if you can script rolling out your applications by group policy, next time you plug in a PC, you can say, right, apply that group policy to that PC, and that will get that latest update.
Yeah.
So another thing I've been working on is looking at maybe deploying a load of, my company's got like 2,000 XP machines, but they've got 300 different applications. And they don't know if those applications will work on XP, and they haven't got a clue. So what we're looking at doing is virtualizing all their apps so that we roll out Windows 7, but we virtualize all their apps. So we just deploy their apps and everything. So it's all very interesting.
Yeah,
so definitely check.
I listened to possibly the same podcast as you. So it was a server show on Podnuts, was it? Because I remember him saying about that. About scripting now in the next 5 years, and didn't they also say something about there's some program where there's a GUI version and a non-GUI version.
You get Windows with he was talking about the server. So Windows 2012, you get it with a GUI or not a GUI, so you can install it and you can do the GUI, and then you can remove the GUI and you just get the core version of it.
Yeah, because
it's very light.
Yeah, because he said it uses much less resources than the whole thing. And I thought, well, that's interesting.
Because most of the vulnerabilities in Windows are in the graphic UI. So if you take the UI out, you haven't got half the issues.
Yeah.
So that guy, Brian from then, he does his DevOpsMastery.com podcast. And he also does this thing called the Linux Install podcast, which is quite good. So you want to check that out. My list of podcasts is getting longer and longer.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I've been listening to loads myself and getting finding new ones, and actually so far I haven't really found one I disliked really. They all have their own interest and their own reasons for listening to it, don't they?
Yeah, but so I'd also like to thank Nightwise for playing his podcast or playing our promo on his podcast.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
yeah. Check out his show. It's quite different from any other. It's all about sliders. So it's all about if you work on Macs, Windows, Linux, and how you can slide between the three of them. Very interesting little podcast. He's really interesting to listen to. In the last episode, we were talking about server migrations and. I can't remember if I mentioned or not. I basically, when I re-listened to it, I've jotted the notes down. I can't remember if I said about transferring the roles from the old domain controller to the new domain controller before decommissioning it. So it's basically 5 FSMO roles, which is flexible single master operations roles. And these are the things that kind of basically control the domain. You need to transfer these over from the old server to the new server, okay? This is what I was thinking about talking about, is that if you're coming from SBS 2003 or whatever to a standalone single domain structure, if you transfer these across, it gives you that 21 days because it notices that these roles have been transferred across, okay? And it will notice that been transferred, and then the SBS server will shutting itself down because it can see another PDC on the domain, so it will shut the server down. So I also recommend those are the last things you transfer across. So I sort of go through these roles with people so people understand what they are. So you've got 5 roles, okay? The first 2 are in the forest wide roles. So what you're thinking, so if you've got a single domain, let's say you've got abnadmin.local, that's one forest and one domain. That's in one forest and one domain. Let's say you wanted to have multiple domains, okay? So you had a UK domain and a US domain. Mm-hmm. What you'd normally do sometimes, you could have a root domain, okay? Which is root.admin.local. And then you'd have 2 separate domains called UK.admin.local and USA.admin.local. So all those domains together is one forest wide, okay? And each of the little domains are all what your domains are called. So your root.admin.local is one domain.
Yeah.
And your UK.admin.local is one domain. And the US.admin.local domain is one separate domain. So with the forest wide range, you'd have these 2 roles, the schema master and the domain name master, the domain naming role, that would be in the whole, you'd only get 2 of them in that one forest, okay? So the schema master is basically where all the schema objects are held in the forest and the tree. And it basically keeps all of them the same in the consistency between the whole objects and the whole forest and the domains, okay? So if you update the schema, you update that one, and then it puts all the schema updates to all the PCs served in the forest and then into the main, okay? And then the domain naming scheme is the one what basically holds all, what basically decides. If you want to add a new domain into your forest, that's the server which decides if you're allowed to call that domain. So if you had uk.abnadmin.local and you want to add a new domain and you want to say, yeah, I'm going to call my one uk.abnadmin.local, it'd go, no, hang on a minute, you already got a domain called uk.abnadmin.local, right. Okay?
Yeah.
See what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
So that's what they are. So those scheme master and a domain naming are only in the forest wide roles. So you would have, you'd in your console, you there's a number of places you can, I can't think of the top of my head, but you can go in, and that's where you basically go into there, go onto the server you want to transfer it to, click on it, and then say transfer to this server. To get to the scheme master one, I think you have to run some DLL register to actually get these the MMC to come up. Okay. So in the domain wide role, so in your domain, so each of the little domains you have, you will have these three roles. So you will need to transfer them in each of the domains. So you've got the RID master, okay? This allocates all the SIDs to the whatever wants a SID. So if you've got a user account what requires a SID, or a computer requires a SID, this RID will give that, will allocate the RIDs. You've got the PCDC emulator. This is basically backward compatibility for with NT, the old PDC, which is basically the primary domain controller, okay? And this is basically in charge of saying who's the primary domain controller and does things like the time for that little domain. And then you've got the infrastructure master, okay, which is all to do with if you've got domains. Basically, the infrastructure master is responsible for updating references from objects in its domains to other objects in other domains. There's a global catalog it's used to compare data as it receives regular updates from all the objects in all domains. All changes to user group inf references are updated by the infrastructure master. For example, if you rename or remove a group member and the member is in a different domain from the group will temporarily appear not to contain that member. So yes, it just kind of does things. If you've got multiple domains and domain trusts, it will just update it. If something gets updated, it will then replicate it between the two domains, okay? Something I didn't talk about is global catalog servers. It's another thing you have to transfer across. Or basically, you have to, when you make a server a DC, you, if you want to be a global catalog server, you have to go into sites and services and click a little box and to make that global catalog. And to remove it, you go into the same place and remove it. But if you've only got one server and you haven't got that global catalog ticked, it will warn you that you haven't got a global catalog ticked, and it will tell you how to do that. Global catalogs are mainly used in when you've got exchange servers and stuff. So I can't remember if I'd mentioned all those FSMO roles, but there is five. So two for forest-wide roles and three for domain-wide roles. So
I don't think you had mentioned them.
So yeah, so you need to transfer them across before you can decommission the old server. Also, once you've got as you've got functionality levels, okay, so you can rise. So what you need to do is that I had this issue the other week, is that like when you introduce new domain controllers into the level, you can have different functionality levels. So like you get Windows 2003 functionality levels, 2008 functionality levels, and 2012 functionality levels. It doesn't mean that it gives you different options. So if you put it higher, like if you put it to 2008 functional level, it means you can't ever introduce any more 2003 domain controllers in anymore. But it might give you features like with 2008, you can, if you delete something in AD, you can roll it back so you can get that, because AD's got a recycle bin once you update the financial level. The functional level. So beware, that's only a one-way go. You can't, once you've updated your financial level, you can only go one way. You can't roll it back.
No, right.
And again, you get domain level functions and forest level functions. So you've got to update all your, so if you've got multiple domains, you need to update the domain level. So if we had three functional levels, you have to update each of those three to first before you can then upgrade to forest, if you see what I mean.
Okay. Right.
So that's all interesting things about that. But things also what we've been interested in at work, because I thought might people know that. I've been talking about Office 365 and how that all works. I found out the other day is that they hadn't, the one that company I've been working for hadn't paid the bill.
And,
okay. And basically it sends you emails that you haven't paid the bill. But when you set up the account and when you tell people, and I got the email and I forwarded it to the accounts person and say, hey, you haven't paid the bill. And goes, yeah, but I haven't got this email. And what's odd is that what you have to do, if you're a billing admin of Office 365 or you're a full admin of Office 365, you have to put an alternative email address, okay? So you have your primary email address and then an alternative email. I can't get my words out tonight. Alternative email address, okay?
Yeah.
But that email address cannot be an email address which is in on Office 365, okay? And so what okay. I did in my testing, when I did in my testing is, I'd put my email address in it because it wouldn't accept any other Office 365 address. And apparently, billing emails or service emails about servers going down only get sent to the alternative email address and not to the primary email address. I mean, how stupid is that? I mean, do they want to get paid or not? And there's no way in the GUI you can change it, because every time you put it in it basically says you can't put an Office 365 address. So there's a little blog post I found out that you have to use a PowerShell command, and you basically connect through Office 365 through PowerShell, and you can you can tell it to use an Office 365 email address as an alternative email address if you use a PowerShell. So if anyone comes across that,
okay,
there you go.
I can see to a degree. If their service gets taken off, then they can't send them an email to the 365 email address because it's not working anymore. So no. They have to send it to an alternative, which I can see for that side. But when it's actually an active account, you know, they want to get told they need to pay the bill before it goes off.
So the alternative one is also for, like, if you want to reset your password, which is fine, but why can't they send your billing to the primary email address as well?
Because most of the time, the alternative one is either somebody else or is not checked as often. The primary one is most likely checked every single day. In fact, I've got some alternative email addresses which I never ever check. I only use it for resetting passwords or things like that. So that's a good little tip in case anyone's come across it. I'm sure lots of people have. I thought, what the hell? Why can't I type this into this box? Frustrating as it is.
The other thing I was mentioning about is that I had with a problem with a group policy. So I was, for one of our customers, they wanted to deploy a proxy server so that they got hit by the crypto locker virus. And they wanted to do the CAFI do a service where you can check all your internet access. So I set it all up. And I wanted to roll the group policy out to different people so that it changed their Internet Explorer policy so that it went through the proxy server. So with group policy, if you define a group policy as a way of basically pushing settings to any computer in the domain. And by default, when you create a group policy, it applies it to every single computer, okay? Sorry, every user who logs on to that computer. So it says, I don't know if you've ever been in there, Andy, but people don't talk about it. It says about authenticated users at the bottom. It will, when you go into group policy, but I didn't want it to apply to everybody. So what you can do is that, what you mustn't do is that you can remove that user from the authenticated user from being applied, okay?
Okay.
So what you should do is that in this is really good if you could have on a podcast, you could actually show you video to explain it. But on the delegation tab of the actual group policy in the group policy management, what you can do is at the bottom there's a thing what says advanced. And when you click on advanced, okay, it basically pops up a window, and it basically like your normal where you go in, and you can see like where you can put reading file permissions. Okay, you can say what you want this group policy to do, and what you can do is you untick under authenticated users. You can untick apply group policy. So you keep the tick box that says read, and you untick apply group policy, which basically means they can read the group policy, but it doesn't get applied. What you do in that box is you click on add, and then you basically put in the user or a group, as I like to do, think by group. So I created a group called apply policy setting or policy or group apply proxy server, and that's the user in there I want. So I haven't got to go and do this every time. All I need to do is add that user into that security group. And all you do is you tick that little, you add that user, that group in, and you tick the box that says read, and then you click on the box that says apply group policy. And basically what that means, if anyone's in that group, we'll basically get that group policy applied, okay? So that's a good little way of making, if you want a group policy to basically be applied, that's the way to, I basically put in the show notes a little article which I found about it, which shows you, explains it. But remember, don't remove the authenticated user completely, because if you do that, it stops all the group policy being that group policy being applied.
Okay, I've got a feeling as well. You know this system that I'm going to be looking after. That group policy is going to come into that as well at some point.
We can definitely do a deep dive into group policy. It's brilliant stuff, unless you have to troubleshoot it. It's the right nightmare to do.
Well, I know. So, yeah, there's a basic. Well, one of the basic things is where these computers are going. One of the issues that they've got is that there are kids basically that use some of the computers. They're a bit older kids, really, high school kind of kids. And as part of the policy is they don't want them on Facebook and Twitter and things like that. So they want them to be blocked from certain websites. Whereas the admins, you know, or the staff and that can go to the likes of Facebook. So I'm assuming that although I've done it a different way in the past. But I'm assuming group policy is one of the ways where you can block websites or put specific rules in for what people can and cannot do.
Yeah, it's not that easy to do free group policy, limiting websites and stuff, so it's probably best to do it using a third-party tool, really. But you can use a lockdown in PC so you can't open certain applications and stuff. So
I've done it before using the host file.
Mm-hmm.
Manually on I think it's about 5 of the computers that they have the kids have access to, so it doesn't matter who logs onto those computers, nobody can get into Facebook, which is actually works next, pretty well. So
my next thing I'm saying is about one of my other things is that with Windows 2012, you set up a new domain from scratch. I'm sure before 2012, someone might be able to correct me on this, is that the default domain admin, the administrator account you created the first, password never expires on it. So you never have to change the password by default. Okay. In Windows 2012, if you set up a brand new domain, the password will actually expire.
Oh god.
And what happened was is that we set up a deployment center for our couple of our deploying. We've got about 50 laptops deployed for a school, and the password basically ran out, and it asked you to change it. So the guy changed it. Then he didn't bother to write it down. So a month later, he came back to it, and he couldn't remember what the password was. So he found a great article online which tells you how to reset the password. I think Mike Tech might have mentioned it on his show about it. But
I remember that. Yes, he did. He did.
It works for domain controllers as well. So what happens is you basically boot the server up, onto using the Windows Pro 2012 DC, and I'm trying to find my page now, it tells me what it is. And you basically boot the server up, and it will basically say, boot it off the DVD ISO image, and it will say, do you want to repair your PC? And you say yes, and and you can basically bring a command prompt up, and what you can do is you can copy from the X sources folder a utilman.exe, and you basically move that to a batch, basically to utilman.exe. You copy that to utilman.exe.back, so you're basically moving it to something else, okay?
Yeah.
And then you basically do command, and then you move command.exe to utilman.exe. And basically, when you've done that, you reboot the PC. As that boots up, it actually brings a command prompt up when you press Control or Delete, and then you can do a net user administrator, and then the new password, and it'll basically reset the password, and then you basically can go in there and log in as that domain controller, that domain admin password. So
that's a good always why you should
keep. Is it always a good thing about? It's not just about security, about actually like firewalls and stuff. It's actually locking down your server's room so you people can't get in it, because when people get physical access to your server, they can do this kind of thing. So I'll put that into the show notes.
That's it.
So
I've had a similar thing. I've also, not for servers but for desktops, I've used a live CD called Trinity Rescue Disk, which is very much a text-based program. And that's been brilliant for resetting passwords and unlocking Windows 7 admin accounts and things like that. It's a really good disk, the Trinity Rescue Disk.
Yeah,
I think the guy who did it has been on a Podnuts episode in the past. I've no idea which show it was on, but it's definitely worth a listen to that show just to learn how this CD works. It's really good. But one of the main features on it that most people use it for is password resetting on the Windows box. You know, people forget it, people have changed it, things like that. So
we've had feedback, haven't we?
Oh, so, that's right. Yeah, I've got one of the. I'll tell you what, I'll go ahead and read one of the emails out now. So, who is this from? This is from Anthony. He says, "Hello, I recently started listening to your podcast when I heard it from the Mike Tech Show. So once again, a big thanks to Mike for giving us a shout out on that. And you talked about in episode 1 monitoring ports on a switch, port monitoring, and some kind of software that you used to do it. I was wondering what that software was. Also, you use some kind of agent on the client server to monitor your clients for any kind of failures. What do you use for that? Can you add any software you talk about, like Mike Smith does, to your show notes as well? That would be awesome. Thanks, guys, for a good podcast. I'm a network admin myself, and I listen on the way and from. So on the way to work and on home again, I guess. And he lives in Denver, Colorado. So that's a good question. Yeah, and I know we've I think on some of the early podcasts we haven't put any real show notes down, did we? But we've done it a few more in the more recent ones.
I've looked at different software. I've gone back and added things in. So a couple of things. So monitoring ports. So it's monitoring ports where I said where you could. You could replicate, or basically this space, whatever goes. So let's say you've got a switch and you've got it going out, that the port where your router is going out into the internet, and you can't work out what's taking up your bandwidth. What you can do is you can mirror that port, so anything on that port gets pushed out onto a second port. Okay, there's a nice bit of software which is Linux based, which is freeware, or not freeware, open source, called NTOP, And that basically draws you a nice little graph which tells you what is going on, which are your top talkers. There's a bit of software called PRCG, which is a Windows application, which is it's basically it does the same thing again, but you have to pay for it. But it's a really good bit of software. You pay by node, but obviously it's a bit of software. You have to have a Windows license. So that's those two things. You've got Cacti as well, which is basically a web monitoring software. It's basically it's quite using SNMP. It's basically you can do the bandwidth. So I do it for a lot of our sites of work, so we can see what the bandwidth for each of the customer sites are. So what you see what ADSL speed they're getting and what they're pushing through. What was you also asking about what monitoring software I use? Well, we already mentioned GFI before, which is a very good tool. We use System Center Operations Manager, SCOM, at work for monitoring most of our clients' software. That's that. I think that covers everything, doesn't it? He was asking.
I think it does. I mean, so most of the time, these are tools that you can find out who's downloading all the movies onto the desktop, isn't it?
Yep, you can see what they're doing, where the IP address is coming from. So
yeah, what are you doing on? I'm doing nothing, really. well, why was there so many movies downloaded? So so that's a good one. We've got another one here as well, haven't we?
Yeah. Okay. From France.
Oh, okay, right. Okay.
Do you want me to read it?
I've got it here ready, yeah. So he says, I really like your podcast. It's really nice to get something from the UK. I feel like I might be a fraud, as I am not a system administrator of a company, but a computer enthusiast dating from the early 70s. But I do use computers as well. As offering guest Wi-Fi and local web server in my business of letting cottages in France, where I live after leaving Liverpool in 1992. Due to the change in satellite UK transmissions to Europe, VPN has become an interest to many expats so that they can use iPlayer. He's talking about BBC iPlayer. In the last episode, you mentioned having previously discussed how to set up a VPN LAN to LAN with the Draytech routers. Did I somehow miss this? Yeah, we did talk about that, didn't we? Because that was one of the projects I was doing. Yeah. I'm doing the same, but I'm having difficulties trying to find a way in which I can pass my guest Wi-Fi traffic to the local internet and pass my separate network traffic via the VPN using the same internet connection with a single dynamic IP address at my end. Any ideas? And he also says, have you thought of setting up a forum? Keep up the good work. And that's from Felix. So good. Interesting email that, yeah.
I don't know if they can do that with Devigle. I'm guessing, I'm trying to work out what I think he's doing here. I did email him back, but haven't heard anything back. But I'm guessing what he's wondering. So he's basically got a Devigle.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we didn't really mention about, we were just talking about the land-to-land stuff. We haven't talked about setting it up, have we? That would definitely be a different podcast. I want to get on to VPN stuff. So that will be interesting. But what I'm thinking he's saying is, so I'm guessing he's in France and he's trying to access the BBC iPlayer. So I'm guessing he's brought some sort of VPN service so that he can route all his traffic via routing it via Britain or whatever. I'm guessing he's paying for a service or he's got a Devigle at the other end. I'm guessing he's got some sort of, with Devigle, you can basically isolate the VPN. If you're on the Wi-Fi, you can isolate it from your internal traffic so they can't access your internal network. But I don't know if you can, because the Devigles are really good, but they are limiting on some of these features.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you can't route that traffic out. So when the traffic is coming from the guest Wi-Fi, I'm guessing it's pushing it down the VPN tunnel. So I wait for clarification on that, but I don't know if it's actually possible to do that on the Vigo. I can't think in my head. But I mean, if you want to get in contact, Ike, we can have a look at doing that for him. Maybe put a thing on the Draytech forums are quite good for that kind of thing. But
yeah,
we use a quality thing at work called Microtix, and they're very powerful. They're very cheap, but they're like your Cisco grade routers, so there's a lot you can do on it.
Can't you do can't you do something like this via tricking your DNS or something like that?
What, to get the iPlayer?
Yeah, I mean, it's the other way around. I mean, if you think about it, for us, you know, if we wanted to pretend we're in you know, another country, can't you do it by tricking the DNS server or something like that? I've never done it myself.
Depends.
But
depends how it works. It's normally what they do, they normally check what IP address you're coming from.
Yeah.
So like with the BBC, it will check, because it knows, like, oh, it goes, right, yeah, I know you're coming from a UK IP address, so you can access the iPlayer. But if you're not on the, but if you're coming from France, it goes, oh yeah, but you're coming from a French IP address.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna let you. You're not gonna let you look at it. So. Idea of a forum. I don't know about a forum, really. It seems a lot of work to looking after. One thing I have noticed is what Podnuts has done is they've closed their forum. They've gone over to the Reddit thing, so people can post their question up on there. So maybe that will be kind of a less, an easier way of getting kind of a way to discuss stuff.
Yeah, could well be. Yeah.
We've covered a lot in that show, I think. We haven't really had a show topic this month, but we had quite a lot to talk about. We haven't had a catch-up. So anything else to add to it, Andy?
I don't think so, no. I mean, it's just been no topic, but just a mass of little topics. So we've we have covered a lot.
Yeah, definitely. If you want to answer your questions, give us a drop us a line. We like the feedback. I always like receiving an email thinking, wow, all these people listening to us. There's two UK guys talking, and it's all people listening to it all over the world. It's quite amazing, really, isn't it?
It is. So,
so you can drop us a mail at mail@adminadminpodcast.co.uk, or you can get me at al@adminadminpodcast.co.uk.
And of course, Andy at adminadminpodcast.co.uk. So that is us for this week, is it? I can't think of anything else we can throw in at the end. So when do you think we'll be carrying on? Another week or 2 weeks or something like that?
Yeah, maybe do a couple more, bit closer to make up the numbers kind of thing. So we'll speak soon, guys.
Okay, see you soon, everyone.